Jamaica did not begin as a culture. It began as a machine, an island cut into fields, timed by bells, ruled by violence. Sugar moved, blood followed, the wealth left, the people stayed. For centuries, Jamaica was designed to extract and discard. Enslaved Africans worked until their bodies broke. When slavery ended, land did not follow. Freedom arrived without power. Survival became the skill that mattered most. But something else was happening beneath the surface, in the hills, in the language, in faith, in food, in the way people refused to disappear. This is not a story about a small island that got lucky. This is a story about endurance under pressure, about systems built to crush a majority, about resistance that did not always look like rebellion, but lasted longer than any empire that tried to control it. We are not here to celebrate. We are here to understand, because Jamaica did not inherit influence. It fought its way into it. Chapter 1. The Sugar Machine. Jamaica did not become a colony by accident. It was taken because it could be turned into profit faster than almost any other place in the Atlantic world. Before Europeans arrived, the island was home to indigenous people who lived off the land and sea. That world was shattered quickly. Spanish control began in the early 1600s and collapsed just as fast. Disease, violence, and neglect emptied much of the island. When the British seized Jamaica in 1655, they did not inherit a thriving colony. They inherited a blank slate built on loss. The British saw opportunity. Jamaica's soil and climate were ideal for sugar. Sugar was not food, it was money, it was fuel for empire. Demand in Europe was exploding, and Jamaica was redesigned to meet it. Forests were cleared, rivers were redirected, land was surveyed, parceled, and fenced. The island became a grid. Sugar plantations were not farms, they were factories spread across open land. Every part of life was timed and controlled. Bells dictated work, whips enforced pace, punishment was public and deliberate. Violence was not random, it was policy. To run this machine, labor had to be imported at scale. Enslaved Africans were brought across the Atlantic in numbers that dwarfed the European population. They arrived stripped of names, languages, and kinship ties, then forced into an economy that treated them as replaceable parts. Mortality was expected, plantations planned for death. New shipments were cheaper than sustaining life. By the early 1700s, Jamaica had one of the most extreme demographic imbalances in the Americas. Enslaved Africans made up the vast majority of the population. White planters and overseers were a small minority, armed and constantly afraid. Control depended on terror, surveillance, and division. Every day on the plantation was engineered to break resistance. Work began before sunrise. Cane cutting destroyed bodies. Boiling houses burned skin and lungs. Injuries were ignored unless they slowed production. Food rations were minimal. Housing was cramped. Families were separated at will. And yet, even inside this system, people found ways to endure. They formed new communities. They preserved fragments of language, belief, and rhythm. They shared food grown in provision grounds carved out of stolen time. These small acts were not romantic. They were necessary. Survival itself became resistance. The plantation owners did not see people. They saw output. Sugar barrels leaving the island represented profit flowing to Britain. Jamaica became one of the crown's most valuable possessions. The wealth built estates, banks, and political power thousands of miles away. On the island, very little was reinvested. Roads served plantations, not villages. Schools were scarce. Healthcare was non-existent for the enslaved. The colony was designed to extract and abandon. Fear shaped every decision made by the ruling class. The enslaved population outnumbered them by huge margins. Rebellion was not a distant threat. It was constant. Runaways fled into the interior. Small acts of sabotage slowed production. Fires destroyed fields. Poisonings were rumored and sometimes real. To counter this, laws grew harsher. Patrols expanded. Punishments became more brutal. Public executions were staged to send messages. Violence had to be visible to be effective. But visibility worked both ways. The enslaved watched. They learned the weaknesses of the system. They mapped the land. They shared information quietly. In the mountains and forests, communities of escaped Africans formed. These Maroons knew the terrain better than any British soldier. They survived where the plantation could not reach. The existence of free black communities terrified the colonial government. They were living proof that the system was not absolute. Military campaigns were launched to destroy them. They failed repeatedly. The terrain favored those who knew it. The British could burn fields, but they could not dominate the hills. By the mid-1700s, the sugar machine was producing immense wealth and deep instability at the same time. Jamaica was rich on paper and fragile in reality. The colony depended entirely on violence to function. Remove the violence, and the system collapsed. Increase it, and resistance hardened. This was the contradiction at the heart of Plantation Jamaica. The island was profitable because it was brutal. It was unstable because it was brutal. Every gain carried the seed of collapse. Planters responded by tightening control even further. New laws restricted movement. Communication between plantations was monitored. African cultural practices were policed. Drums were banned. Gatherings were limited. Fear of unity drove policy. Still, unity found ways to grow. Faith adapted. Stories carried memory. Names were passed down in secret. The plantation could control bodies, but it could not fully erase identity. That failure mattered. By the late 1700s, global pressure began to shift. Abolitionist movements gained strength in Britain. Economic arguments emerged alongside moral ones. Sugar profits were still massive, but the cost of constant repression was rising. Revolts across the Caribbean signaled that the era of total control was cracking. Jamaica stood at the center of this storm. The colony had been engineered for extraction, not sustainability. There was no plan for a future beyond sugar, no pathway for a stable society, only output. As we look at this period, it is important to be clear. The violence was not accidental. It was designed. The wealth was not shared. It was exported. The instability was not surprising. It was inevitable. Jamaica did not stumble into suffering. It was built into the blueprint. And yet, despite everything, the people endured. They adapted. They resisted in ways both visible and hidden. The sugar machine could dominate land and labor, but it could not fully control spirit or memory. The British believed the island was secured by law and force. They believed terror would last forever. They were wrong. In the mountains, beyond the cane fields and the reach of the whip, a different Jamaica was already taking shape. Chapter 2. Fire in the Hills. The British learned early that Jamaica could not be ruled from the plantations alone. Control required war. Runaways did not disappear into the bush by chance. They moved with purpose. The interior of Jamaica was rugged, steep, and difficult to penetrate. Dense forests and sharp ridges made traditional European warfare useless. Those who escaped slavery used this terrain to their advantage. They built settlements far from roads and fields. They farmed, hunted, and defended themselves. These communities became known as the Maroons. To the colonial government, the Maroons were not simply fugitives. They were an existential threat. Maroons raided plantations for supplies. They freed others. They disrupted production. Most importantly, they proved that Africans could live free on the island and defeat British forces repeatedly. This challenged the core myth of colonial power. The British responded with military campaigns that dragged on for decades. Soldiers unfamiliar with the climate fell ill. Ambushes were common. Entire units were lost in terrain they could not read. The cost of war grew high, both financially and psychologically. Eventually, the British made a decision that revealed their fear. They negotiated. In the 1830s of the 1700s, treaties were signed with several Maroon groups. The agreements recognized Maroon freedom and land rights in exchange for peace. On paper, it was a compromise. In reality, it was an admission. The empire could not fully conquer Jamaica. But the treaties carried consequences. Some Maroon communities were obligated to return future runaways. This created painful divisions among Black Jamaicans. Survival under colonial rule often demanded impossible choices. Resistance did not end with the treaties. It shifted. On the plantations, enslaved people continued to sabotage production. Tools broke, cane spoiled. Illness was sometimes exaggerated to slow work. Communication networks spread news between estates. The system required constant vigilance to function, and vigilance exhausted its enforcers. Religion became another battleground. Christian missionaries arrived claiming moral purpose. Many enslaved Jamaicans adopted Christianity, but not passively. They reshaped it. Biblical stories of bondage and liberation resonated deeply. Faith became a language for resistance. By the early 1800s, pressure was building from multiple directions. Abolitionist campaigns in Britain grew louder. Slave revolts across the Caribbean revealed how fragile plantation societies had become. Jamaica was sitting on dry ground. The spark came in 1831. The Baptist War, also known as the Christmas Rebellion, began as a strike. Enslaved Jamaicans demanded wages and fair treatment, believing that freedom had already been granted and withheld illegally. When negotiations failed, the uprising spread rapidly. Plantations burned. Work stopped. Tens of thousands participated. The British response was swift and merciless. Martial law was declared. Hundreds were killed in battle. Thousands more were executed afterward. Entire communities were destroyed. Missionaries suspected of sympathy were arrested or expelled. The rebellion was crushed, but the message could not be buried. The cost of repression shocked British society. Reports of mass executions and scorched earth tactics reached London. The illusion that slavery could be managed humanely collapsed. Within a few years, slavery was abolished across the British Empire. In 1838, full emancipation arrived in Jamaica. Freedom, however, came with limits. The formerly enslaved received no land, no compensation, no political power. Former slave owners were paid for their losses. The freed population was expected to continue working the same estates under new terms. When that failed, the colonial government imposed the apprenticeship system, forcing people to labor for years after slavery officially ended. Once again, freedom was delayed by design. Many Jamaicans refused plantation labor altogether. They pooled resources to buy small plots of land. They formed free villages. Subsistence farming replaced sugar work. This shift terrified planters, who depended on cheap labor to survive. The colonial government responded with new controls. Taxes were imposed that could only be paid in cash, forcing people back into wage labor. Vagrancy laws criminalized unemployment. Courts favored landowners. Power remained firmly in colonial hands. Tension exploded again in 1865. At Morant Bay, a protest over land access and justice turned violent after authorities opened fire. The uprising spread briefly before being crushed. The response was brutal. Hundreds were killed. Many more were flogged or imprisoned without trial. Villages were destroyed. The British government used the rebellion as justification to change Jamaica's political structure. Local assemblies were dissolved. Direct Crown Colony rule was imposed. Power was centralized under the governor. Representation vanished. Order was restored. Justice was not. The message was clear. Political resistance would not be tolerated. Economic independence would be punished. Jamaica would remain controlled, even without slavery. Yet despite repression, a new society was forming. Peasant farming expanded, informal markets thrived, mutual aid networks grew stronger, churches, schools, and local leaders filled gaps left by the colonial state. Survival once again demanded creativity. By the late 19th century, Jamaica was no longer a slave society, but it was not free. Poverty was widespread, land ownership remained unequal, migration became an escape route. Jamaicans left for Panama, Central America, and later Britain, seeking opportunity denied at home. The island carried the scars of centuries of extraction and resistance. Every attempt to control it had produced new forms of defiance. Every crackdown had planted seeds for something else. The British believed emancipation had ended the problem. They believed order had been restored. But beneath the surface, the question had only sharpened. If freedom without power was not enough, what would it take for Jamaicans to claim their future on their own terms? That question would soon collide with a changing world, and Jamaica would be forced to answer it. Chapter 3. Small Island, Loud Voice. By the early 20th century, Jamaica had survived slavery, rebellion, and direct colonial rule, but survival had come at a cost. Poverty was widespread. Political power was tightly controlled. The island was no longer legally enslaved, yet the structures of extraction remained intact. Sugar was declining. Opportunities were scarce. For many Jamaicans, the future did not appear to exist at home. So people moved. Migration became one of Jamaica's most important survival strategies. Workers left for Panama to build the canal. Others went to Cuba, Costa Rica, and later to Britain, Canada, and the United States. They sent money back home. Remittances supported families, built houses, and funded education. The island began to stretch beyond its shores. This movement changed Jamaica permanently. Those who left carried language, faith, and memory with them. They also carried anger and ambition. They saw how other societies functioned. They learned how power was organized elsewhere. When some returned, they brought new expectations. At home, political consciousness was rising. Labor unrest exploded in the 1930s. Workers across the island protested low wages, poor conditions, and lack of representation. Strikes shut down industries. Police repression followed. Several people were killed. Once again, violence was used to maintain order. But this time, something shifted. Out of the labor movement emerged new leaders. Trade unions formed. Political parties followed. Mass politics entered Jamaican life for the first time. The struggle moved from plantations and hillsides into public squares and negotiations. The push towards self-government accelerated after the Second World War. Britain, weakened and facing pressure across its empire, could no longer justify permanent control. In 1962, Jamaica became independent. Independence was a victory, but it was not an ending. The new nation inherited deep inequality, limited resources, and an economy still shaped by external demand. Political competition was intense, expectations were high, reality was unforgiving. The Cold War arrived quickly. Foreign powers took interest in Jamaica's direction. Economic aid came with conditions. Ideological pressure followed. Political rivalry hardened. Violence increased, particularly in urban areas where poverty and political loyalty collided. Communities paid the price. Despite this, something extraordinary was happening at the same time. Jamaica was shaping culture in ways that no one had predicted. Language evolved. Jamaican speech patterns traveled with migrants and media. Faith traditions adapted and spread. Rastafari, once persecuted and marginalized, articulated a worldview that challenged colonial values and global hierarchies. It rejected material excess, emphasized African identity, and insisted on spiritual freedom. Sport became another outlet. Jamaican athletes carried national pride onto international stages. Success was celebrated not as individual achievement, but as proof that the island could compete with the world. Culture became Jamaica's loudest voice. Without armies or empires, Jamaica projected influence through ideas, style, and attitude. It spoke back to history. It redefined Black identity on a global scale. It refused invisibility. This influence was not accidental. It was forged by pressure. Centuries of extraction had forced Jamaicans to innovate with limited resources. Survival demanded creativity. Community filled the gaps left by the state. Expression became both release and resistance. At the same time, the island continued to struggle. Debt mounted. International financial institutions imposed austerity. Public services weakened. Violence became entrenched in some neighborhoods, fueled by political rivalry, economic desperation, and global drug routes. Tourism grew, but profits often flowed outward. Once again, Jamaica risked becoming a product rather than a beneficiary. The contradiction remained. Jamaica was globally influential and locally constrained, celebrated abroad and burdened at home. Its image traveled faster than its prosperity, and yet resilience persisted. Families adapted. Informal economies sustained communities. Education remained a priority despite obstacles. Migration continued, not as surrender, but as strategy. Jamaicans learned to exist in multiple worlds at once, rooted at home and connected abroad. This is what transformed Jamaica into a cultural superpower. Not size, not wealth, experience. An island that had been engineered to serve others learned how to speak for itself. It took fragments left by empire and turned them into identity. It survived systems designed to erase it and emerged with a voice that could not be ignored. But resilience is not the same as resolution. The legacy of colonialism still shapes land ownership, economic vulnerability, and political trust. External pressures remain. Climate threats loom. The future is not guaranteed. Jamaica's greatest achievement may not be what it has given the world, but what it has refused to lose. The question now is not whether Jamaica can influence global culture. That has already been answered. The question is whether the resilience that carried it through slavery, rebellion, and extraction can finally be converted into full sovereignty on its own terms. That answer is still being written.